Council to abandon such abuses and work instead to compensate for them. Sayed Mohammad Sadatinejad, who is in charge of the human rights issues at the Iranian diplomatic mission to the United Nations in Geneva, made the remarks on Monday, 9th of November, during the Human Rights Council's 36th session of Universal Periodic Review that examined the human rights situation in the United States. Sadatinejad set forth 9 recommendations for the U.S. delegation, which was led by the U.S. Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor Assistant Secretary Robert Destro, Ambassador in Geneva Andrew Bramberg, and Acting Legal Advisor Marek String. Sadatinejad said America should end its arbitrary and systematic killings using drones and bring to justice those who assassinated 5 Iranian citizens, including top anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq on 3rd of January this year. Lieutenant General Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, and 4 other Iranians were martyred in a U.S. drone strike ordered by President Donald Trump upon their arrival in Baghdad International Airport on 3rd of January this year. The Iranian delegation had arrived in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government. The attack also killed Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes, the second in command of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, PMUs. The two commanders were highly popular because of their key role that they played in eliminating the U.S.-sponsored Daesh terrorist group in the region. Meanwhile, regarding arbitrary and systematic killings by American drones, Iran's judiciary chief pledged that Tehran will not back off from efforts to punish those who assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, and imposed sanctions on Iran, even though Donald Trump is leaving the White House with blood on his hands. Addressing a recent session of the Judiciary's Supreme Council, Sayed Ebrahim Raisi said, "Although a terrorist that has the blood of Iran's national hero on its hands has been thrown out of the White House, the Islamic Republic will not give up the firm resolve to punish those behind the assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the economic terrorists who have committed crimes against Iranians by imposing sanctions." The head of Iran's judiciary, Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, added the assassination of the prominent international figure in the war on terrorism was a cruel action not only against the Iranian nation, but against all regional and all Muslim countries. He said an example of such cruelty was a recent terrorist attack that Daesh terrorists launched at the University of Kabul in Afghanistan. The head of Iran's judiciary further explained that the ignorant terrorists that attacked the university in Kabul and martyred innocent Afghan students have been created by U.S. Democrats and employed by the Republicans. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian diplomat Sayed Mohammad Sadatinejad called on U.S. to take necessary legal and judicial measures towards ending systematic racism against minorities in the U.S., including African Americans. He also urged an end to the unilateral U.S. sanctions against other nations, which have led to serious human rights breaches. He added the U.S. should also cooperate with the United Nations Special Rapporteur on negative effects of its coercive actions. Sadatinejad further said Washington should halt the arbitrary detention of Iranians on fake charges of violating U.S. sanctions. He said the United States must end its complicity in the crimes committed by Saudi Arabia and the Israeli regime against the Yemeni people and the Palestinians, respectively, and stop selling weapons to both of those regimes. Additionally, he recommended Washington to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to investigate war crimes committed by U.S. military forces in Afghanistan. The top Iranian diplomat concluded the U.S. should also end the practice of separating migrant children from their parents and putting them in cages. Besides the Islamic Republic of Iran, other countries such as Syria, Venezuela, Russia, China, criticized Washington's human rights record. Counselor Hola Youssef of Syria said the United States should end its executive order imposing sanctions on Syria, halting occupation of her country, hold its military personnel to account for the war crimes they have committed in Syria, and end support for various terrorist groups in the country. Also, China's representative at the United Nations Human Rights Council, Jiang Duan, cited 9 points of concern regarding the United States, among them systematic racism, politicization of the coronavirus pandemic, and proliferation of guns and military interventions abroad in other countries. The Chinese representative, Jiang Duan, said, "Stop interfering for political reasons in other countries' internal affairs under the pretext of human rights. Washington's own allies, including Austria and Netherlands and Germany, also called on U.S. to ratify various treaties aimed at guaranteeing human rights and expressed concern about racial inequalities and gun violence in the United States, among other things." According to a Reuters news agency report, activists also said on Monday, 9th of November, that the Human Rights Council's examination of the United States, the first since May of 2015, amounted to an indictment of the Trump administration's misguided policies, and called on President-elect Joe Biden to usher in reforms. Jamil Dakwa, director of the Human Rights Program at the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, told the news briefing, "What we saw today was unsurprising condemnation by many countries around the world of the United States' human rights record." Jamil Dakwa said, "We've heard country after country calling and urging the United States to take serious action to address structural racism and police violence in the U.S. The Trump administration, which quit the Geneva Forum in June of 2018, accusing it of anti-Israel bias, defended America's policies. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Robert Destro told the U.N. Human Rights Council, "Our presence in this process demonstrates our nation's commitment to human rights." The case of George Floyd, an African-American man who died in May of this year after a white police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes, ignited massive protests across the United States and indeed throughout the world, putting the country's human rights record in sharp focus. Alexander Mulgrew, U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General, said authorities in Minneapolis, Minnesota had filed second-degree murder and manslaughter charges in George Floyd's death. Mulgrew said a number of member states raised concerns about discrimination and excessive use of force by police officers. Where there is misconduct by police officers or law enforcement agencies, state and federal law should provide remedies. Cuba and Venezuela also said the United States must provide equal access to health care during the COVID-19 pandemic. France called on the United States to hold executions at the federal level, to close down the Guantanamo Bay detention facility, and guarantee women and girls access to their rights and sexual and reproductive health. Britain called on the United States to ensure access to comprehensive sexual and reproductive health services. Joshua Cooper of the U.S. Human Rights Network, a national network of campaigners, said more than a dozen countries voiced concern at the U.S. position on family planning. Moreover, there is concern about the state of U.S. prisons. The number of U.S. prison inmates dying in the country's more than 500 top jails has climbed by more than 8% since the last official figure was released back in 2016. According to an investigative report published recently by Reuters news agency, the U.S. prison death rate surged overall in the first 3 years of the Trump administration to its highest point in the 12-year period of 2008 to 2019, after leveling off in 2016. At least two-thirds of the deceased inmates identified in the report between 2008 and 2019, that is, a total of 4,998 individuals, were still awaiting their day in court and presumed innocent when they lost their lives in jail, whilst never convicted of the charges on which they were being held. Using more than 1,500 public record requests, Reuters news agency surveyed 523 prisons for 12 years of inmate death records. All U.S. jails with 750 or more inmates, as well as the 10 largest prisons in the United States. In most states across the country, which has the world's largest prison population, the resulting database represents the largest accounting of prison deaths outside the U.S. federal government. It details more than 7,500 inmate deaths in a number of jails that account for three-fifths of total U.S. prison population. According to the report, the death rate in the 523 jails soared 35% over the decade ending last year, fueled by illness, increasing number of suicides and overdoses from drugs and alcohol abuse in prison compounds that get little oversight and sometimes provide inadequate medical and mental health services to the inmates. The report further revealed that more than 2,000 inmates took their own lives, including nearly 1,500 that were still awaiting a trial or indictment. An increasing number, more than 1 in 10 last year, died from dire consequences of taking drugs and alcohol in prison. About 300 others lost their lives after languishing behind bars, without even being convicted of an offense, for a year or more. The data further demonstrates that while officials claim the suicide rate in U.S. prisons declined over the past 3 years due to the enforcement of suicide awareness and response initiatives, the death rate from drug and alcohol abuse and overdoses surged by nearly 72% amid the country's opioid epidemic. The U.S. Justice Department's Bureau of Justice Statistics, BJS, has collected inmate mortality data for 2 decades. It issues reports with national-level data on jail deaths and some state-level numbers. But death statistics for individual jails are withheld from the public. Government officials and oversight agencies, under a 1984 law limiting the release of BJS, Bureau of Justice Statistics, data. Meanwhile, China has censured the United States and its Western allies for violating human rights in a joint statement on behalf of 26 countries during the recent session of the United Nations General Assembly. China's ambassador to the United Nations General Assembly, Zhang Jun, further demanded the complete and immediate removal of U.S.-led unilateral sanctions on other countries during the general debate of the UN General Assembly's Third Committee on Monday, 5th of October. Also pointing to the harsh impact of the coronavirus pandemic on all nations, particularly developing countries, the Chinese ambassador to the UN, Zhang Jun, said, "We continue to witness the application of unilateral coercive measures which are contrary to the purpose and principles of the United Nations Charter and international law, multilateralism, and the basic norm of international relations." The Chinese diplomat delivered a statement on behalf of 26 countries including Angola, Antigua, Barbuda, Belarus, Burundi, Cambodia, Cameroon, China, Cuba, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Islamic Republic of Iran, Myanmar, Namibia, Laos, Nicaragua, Pakistan, Palestine, Russia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, South Sudan, Sudan, Suriname, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe. Noting that the response to and the recovery from COVID-19 required global solidarity and international cooperation, the Chinese ambassador further emphasized that unilateral coercive measures had an undeniable impact on human rights, and they impeded the full realization of social and economic development, and hindered the well-being of the population, especially women and children, in those nations that had been targeted. Insisting that the inhuman sanctions hampered access to medicines and medical technology, medical equipment and supplies, Zhang Jun said, "This is particularly relevant in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic." Senior United Nations officials and the international community have recognized the heavy and negative impact of these measures. Zhang Jun further pointed to the persisting racial discrimination and police violence in the United States, highlighting the police killing of George Floyd and also Jacob Blake in recent months. He said, "Nearly 20 years after the adoption of the Durban Declaration, instances of such brutal killings of African Americans and other vulnerable people by police officers continue to take place very regularly in the United States." The Chinese diplomat Zhang Jun stressed that such cruel treatment of minorities by law enforcement authorities serve as a reminder that chronic and deep-rooted racial discrimination and police brutality are very much alive in the United States. He said the COVID-19 mortality rate was disproportionately higher among minorities, and in particular people of African descent in some countries. Zhang Jun said the detention of refugees practiced by Western countries also constitutes a form of racial discrimination. The senior Chinese diplomat added, "We also express our deep concern over the health situation of migrants at immigration detention centers in certain countries that reflects a contemporary form of racial discrimination."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Tonight, inshallah, I would like to give a reminder to myself and to all of you, justice and injustice when it comes to the rights of believers. In one tradition, we're told that one time Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa ala, he normally, after his Fajr prayer, he would recite the aqibat, he would engage in, for example, du'as, extra prayers, reciting Quran. But this particular Fajr prayer, he turns around and he addresses the people and he says that, "Is any one of you from this particular tribe?" And they're all confused and they say that, "Okay, well, yeah, there's somebody here, he's from that tribe." So he says that there is somebody who was martyred from your tribe, and in the realm of, in another realm, I was given the information that this person owed some money. And in order for him to be able to enter paradise, that money has to be paid off. So even when it comes to like a shaheed, right, even that person, you know, has given up everything and sacrificed. If they haven't observed the rights of the people, then it's something that is serious. Right? So one of the takeaways, when we're talking about justice, one of the takeaways that I would like to take from tonight, and I hope inshallah that you can also, is to think about this, that what are the rights that we have towards one another, towards believers? What is it that can be done in order to learn about those and to observe them. I'll give you a couple of examples. In one of the traditions, we're told that our sixth Imam alayhi salam, that one time there was one of the companions by the name of Hussein ibn A'la. His name was Hussein. So Hussein was one of the good companions. He was going for Hajj, and he was going with a group of his caravan. He was traveling with them, and along the way, it was quite a journey. Every time they would kind of have a stop, they would camp out for a night. Hussein, who was quite well-to-do, he would sacrifice, like a lamb, right? And then it would be like a meal for everyone to eat. And so, he would do it in order to like just help people. And so eventually, when they made their way to Mecca, he greets the Imam. And once again, he sees that the Imam, alayhi salam, is not happy with him. And he asks him that, what have you done? Why is it that you have humiliated your fellow believers? Now Hussein is confused, right? Because he says that, what do you mean? I mean, I was traveling with them and I was trying to help them. I was sacrificing along the way. How have I humiliated them? And the Imam alayhi salam tells him, well, didn't you think about this point? That when you're sacrificing the lambs, there was others who were in your group who didn't have that ability to do this. Right? They couldn't afford that type of thing. And when they saw you doing this at each point, then they felt something in their hearts. Now go and see what you can do to compensate for the feeling that you put into their hearts. And when we come across these type of traditions, I think you'll agree with me that sometimes we feel a sense of maybe even being a bit scared, right? Because the expectations that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam want for us is high. And maybe not all of us are, we're not at the position of, let's say, Ishaq ibn Ammar or Hussein ibn A'la, but you can see how the Ayyama alayhi salam wanted those who are truly striving to be their Shias to have this type of regard and to observe these type of rites. I want to just end or draw to a conclusion by narrating one more story. This is a story which is told regarding there's a famous individual who lived not too long ago that many of the living scholars had a chance to meet, and they testified to like this person's sincerity and his purity. His name was Rajab Ali Khayyat. I don't know if you've heard of him. So he was somebody who was given special gifts because of his purity, because of the taqwa that he had, the good choices that he made. And sometimes, people, when they were stuck, they would go to him for some advice. So, there's a story that's told related to him, that there was a man who had, this business prospect. He had bought some land and he had developed the land, and he wanted to, sell the homes and basically make his investment, make his money back off of his investment. And whatever he did, it just wouldn't sell. And, he didn't know what to do. And it got to the point where the debtors were going to collect the money from him and didn't know what to give. He was going to be thrown into prison. He didn't have anything to give because he hadn't sold anything. So he had, he was like, what can I do? Let me go visit this man. Maybe he can give me some spiritual advice. And as I said, some of the problems that we have in our life, sometimes the root of it is in the spiritual world. So he goes to Rajab Ali Khayyat, and he tells him that I think it might have something to do with haqqun nas, with the rights of people. And he starts to talk to him, and he says, I think it might have something to do with your sister. Maybe there's something that you need you to like sort of settle with her. So the man says that, yes, actually, if I think about it, there's some amount of money that I owed her, and I haven't given to her yet. So let me go see if I can fix that up. And so he goes and he settles this with his sister, and then he comes back after some time and he says that, okay, I think that it's settled. Rajab Ali Khayyat says that, I think that it's not settled. You're telling me it's settled? I think there's still something else there. And eventually, he's able to guide him. He says that, I think your sister's actually really unhappy with you still. She's saying that she's okay with you, but she's still unhappy. See what you can do to make her heart happy. And eventually, he goes back and he eventually promises her one of the houses. He said, okay, I'm developing it. I'm going to give you one of the houses. And at that point, she's happy with him. And when he goes back to Rajab Ali Khayyat for the third time, he says that now your problem is solved. And then for the next day, he started selling the houses and everything was fine. Why do I mention this? Because when it comes to this the difficulty that's involved with, you know, making others pleased with us after we violated their rights. It can be so difficult. Sometimes we just give up. Right? We say that, you know what, it's better, I'll just keep this bad blood between us. Right? I cut off ties with them, but it's too hard for me to go and make that phone call and to go and visit them. Maybe, you know, it could be a parent, it could be a brother or a sister, whatever it is. Sometimes it's just too much of an ego thing or too difficult, and we're like, ah, we'll just leave them. But brothers and sisters, when all this, if you put all this together, you see that on one hand, it can be a very severe thing for us to not fulfill the rights of believers. And on the other hand, we can be losing out on so much spirituality and so much of the higher realms of existence and the purpose of our being by not observing the rights of believers. So on a night like tonight, where we are trying to be inspired with the message of justice of Imam Hussein Islam, let's look for justice in all different dimensions. Yes, we want to, inshallah, eventually discuss, you know, justice and injustice at the societal level. I have some points I'd like to present on that. But even at this level as well too. We have a tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen, Islam. He says that, O Shias, be aware that you do not become the fuel for the fire of hell. He's talking to the Shias. And then he goes on to say that the way that you can become the fire, the actual fire, the actual fuel for the fire, that you can become the chains that our people are fettered with, is by doing dhulm to your fellow Shias, by not observing the rights. Now, imagine if it's one's own mother or one's own father or brother or sister, then what sort of is happening there on a spiritual level? On the other hand, we have traditions where the imams tell us that if you're able to fix your relationship with the believers, that special proximity that you have with them, which is called wilaya in the terminology of ahadith, then that wilaya becomes your connection with us, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And that connection with us, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, becomes your connection with Allah Ta'ala. So it works both ways. We pray to Allah Ta'ala that we can learn from the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, apply them to our lives and convey them to others as well too.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Azim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen. وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On the news line.
Beautiful game, as they call it, was supposed to bring people from around the world together enabling nations and races to mix on the field, playing a sport loved by all. Yet, it seems in England, the beautiful game has an ugly side. Not from the fouls committed by the players during the match, but from the very top of the governing body ruling the sport, the FA. The chief of the English Football Association, which is one of the world's oldest and most respected, has resigned after a storm ensued following the use of language used by the boss when describing black players making their living in the English leagues. Greg Clark was forced to apologise after he used the word coloured to describe black players, a term that's derogatory in nature and highly offensive. Furthermore, he also used other discriminatory slurs against other minorities in the sport, including women. One would have imagined that the UK of all nations would have taken note of the protests sparked by the murder of George Floyd in the US, with the protests even hitting the streets of the UK in the process. Yet it seems that the banners, adverts and campaigns to stop racism in Britain are facing an impossible battle, in particular when the very highest echelons of authority are themselves racist. Football in particular is most interesting in England, with players taking to their knees before each match as a sign of respect to the Black Lives Matter protests. Yet, as one professional football describes, the only disease in the world right now that appears to be unbeatable is racism, with Raheem Sterling himself suffering horrific abuse on the pitch from racist fans. But the truth of the matter is simple. Britain has been pulling the wool over the eyes of many by claiming that racism doesn't exist in the country. However, this could not be further from the truth, as no matter how many television adverts portray mixed-race couples living together, or the government placing token black and ethnic minority ministers in seats, the fact is, Britain is racist to the core, from the top down. So how then can Britain truly put an end to this horrific discrimination, with this in mind?
It's certainly true that there have been a lot of efforts by governments, both Labour and Conservative, over the years to try to tackle the problem of racism, including in sport and especially in football. But as we saw in the case with Mr. Clark, who used a term to refer to black people, which these days is not acceptable, he very quickly was under pressure to resign and accepted that what he'd said was unacceptable. But what's happening is that in all parts of society and all companies, including sports companies, basically people are going through what's called unconscious bias training. In other words, they may not think they're racist, but they need to learn how to relate to people of different ethnicities and what sort of language to use so as not to be unintentionally racist in their behaviour.
Across the UK, the race divide is highlighted more than ever around the towns and cities of the country, with many of the poorest areas having large populations of black and ethnic minority residents living within their boundaries. This has sparked a subconsciously racist approach in the way that certain institutions deal with such minorities across Britain. For one, the police, who claim to be improving their diversity quotas, are one of the most racist institutions in the UK, with one ex-officer claiming that being a minority in the police means dealing with racism by one's own colleagues is a daily occurrence. With racism clearly an issue within police stations around Britain already being a major factor, things are even worse on the streets, with reports claiming that the Metropolitan Police in London, which is the UK's most diverse city, is more than four times more likely to use force on black people than on other races, hence cementing the point further. But such issues can be seen around the nation, with more favourable facilities being granted to white British people over ethnic minority races, ranging inequality at educational institutions, housing, medical care, social benefits, and fighting poverty, with the racism filtering top down when it comes to how certain areas are dealt with. In spite of high-profile faces, such as Manchester United star Marcus Rashford, aiming to get the government to wake up and feed the disadvantaged proportions of the population, it's the case that the UK government and its range of institutions are simply picking and choosing who they help, based not on merit and need, but on race and social class.
When the first black and Asian immigrants came to Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, they did indeed take much of the low paid work in the public transport sector, in factories, cleaning jobs and so on. And so the communities were much poorer. Since then, there has been greater social mobility, though. We see black people and Asian people in as university professors, mayor of London, certain government ministers, though still there are a lot of BME people who are in the lower paid job.
Canada has always boasted itself about its human rights records on the international stage. Yet a recent report by Human Rights Watch says there's much to be done regarding human rights in Canada. According to the report, there remain considerable challenges to undoing decades of structural and systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada.
We had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that involved the truth-telling of the residential school system several years ago, and it came out with over 200 recommendations for Canada as a whole to take action to reconcile and to remedy a lot of these issues that are contributing to these violations. And it's very, very slow going.
Inadequate access to clean, safe drinking water, federal government's reckless discrimination against Indigenous people by denying them funding for child and family services, and widespread discrimination against First Nations women and their descendants are just a few examples cited by the report.
Canada has failed to remedy its treatment against Indigenous peoples in this country for hundreds of years. It's the ongoing assault against our people in this country. It's the legacy of colonialism and Indian Act policies that are oppressive against our people, the remnants of the residential school legacy that left our people very broken.
Back in September, the world was shocked after an Indigenous was left dying in a hospital after being mocked and insulted by the medical staff. The gruesome death was a reminder of systematic racism in the Canadian society. Back in June, the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, launched by the government in 2016 to address endemic levels of violence against Indigenous women and girls, released its final report. The inquiry made 231 recommendations and concluded that acts of violence against Indigenous women and girls amount to genocide.
So in regards to the water crisis that we have, at any time in Canada, there's approximately 100 First Nations across the country that have lack of access to clean drinking water. It's so bad that just a few weeks ago, an entire First Nation community in Northern Ontario was evacuated.
The Human Rights Report also blasted Canada's government for detaining children in immigration centres. According to reports, 118 children were detained or housed in a detention centre in 2018 to 2019. The Canadian government has also been criticised for interfering in the affairs of other countries. Canada has consistently meddled in the affairs of Venezuela. It has imposed several rounds of sanctions and temporarily suspended its diplomatic operations in Caracas. In June, Canada announced sanctions against Nicaragua for its alleged human rights violations. This interventionist policy has been in line with Washington's policy against leftist governments in Latin America. The Canadian government is also under pressure to end its $15 billion arms contract with Saudi Arabia. Canada has yet to suspend existing arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition, despite policy guidelines urging close control over exports of military equipment to countries with a record of human rights violations.
And Canada should not just say, well, I'm sorry, there's commercial considerations and there's the fight against terrorism by Saudi Arabia. What has happened in Yemen is terrible in terms of human rights. And the fact that Canada would pay a penalty is not relevant when it comes to human rights. And no, Canada is one of the only countries now, apart from the United States, that hasn't done anything. Germany has suspended.
Canada is yet to release the findings of its 2018 review of military export permits to the kingdom. Canada is also under fire to hold Myanmar accountable for the genocide of Rohingya Muslims.
In a digital world where messages can be sent in an instant, it's been interesting to note just who sent their messages of congratulations to President-elect Joe Biden and who didn't. For many world leaders, the dutiful message was sent in quick time, but for others, many question the rationale behind the delay. One country that has made their feelings clear from the start is the Islamic Republic of Iran, who from the offset have stated that the eventual outcome would not change Iranian foreign policy. But one message that did slip through is the Iranian president's thoughts as to the so-called JCPOA and potential of the US returning to the table. With the JCPOA being ratified by the United Nations, the deal has been written into law and is hence why President Rouhani of Iran has warned that the Americans must learn from the mistakes of their past and insists that Washington use the election of Joe Biden as president to follow a legal and legitimate path back to its international commitments. But for one of the United States' closest allies, it seems that the arrival of Joe Biden as president could spell a huge change in policy, with the Israeli regime quickly stating that Biden being able to re-enter the deal with Iran would be no easy feat. However, is this just Israel scaremongering Biden into avoiding building closer ties with Iran, which will ultimately alienate the Netanyahu and Tel Aviv regime? In fact, so worried is the Israeli regime that one Knesset lawmaker has stated that Biden's likely policies with Iran could lead to the Israeli regime entering a physical conflict with Iran over the notion of nuclear issues. However, Iran has always stated that any nuclear program that it pursues is solely intended for civilian purposes. But with West Asia being so full of fallout left behind by the Trump government, how then will Joe Biden approach the area when he comes into office? And will US foreign policy under Biden truly be designed to bridge the gaps haphazardly created by Trump?
I think what we will see regarding the Middle East is he will want to rejoin the JCPOA and become part of that again. However, the Iranian government has rightly said that the US would need to make some compensation for the damage it has done in these last 2 years since Trump pulled out of it. So that will not be as smooth a transition, a smoother re-entry to the JCPOA as Biden might like to think.
Much like the Israeli regime realizing the election of Joe Biden will be a game changer for them, so too, it seems, does the UK realize that the United States may see a very different relationship with Britain when Biden comes into office, meaning that ties with Britain and the US may no longer be such a special relationship. Already, Joe Biden has warned Britain that it will be placed at the back of the queue when it comes to the job list that he's set up. Already, Biden has to somehow reunite the people of his own country before worrying about a dividing Europe, meaning that Britain may find itself in trouble come January. With Boris Johnson already struggling to secure a deal with the EU and now facing the prospect of having nothing to grasp onto in the US, could the election of Biden spell bad news for Boris? For one, Biden is already fuming at the so-called internal market bill, which could upset the Good Friday Agreement, a topic close to the heart of the Catholic and Irish descendant president-elect Joe Biden. But Johnson's already starting to suffer defeats at home, as the House of Lords have already waved away his internal market bill, much to his embarrassment. It seems that the British have also fallen on bad times with the Brexit deal so far failing, and Biden unlikely to prop up the blundering mistakes of Boris Johnson, which could leave the British very much isolated and very much in economic and political pain. But with many nations around the world planning and preparing for a post-Trump era and promises of a new start with Joe Biden, is it simply just too soon to decide just how each nation wishes to interact with the US, reminding us all not to count our chickens before they hatch?
Yes, it is early for leaders of other countries to be approaching Biden, president-elect, and talking about trade deals and so on. However, I think people are so anxious to deal with someone who will be at least reasonable that they are reaching out now, even though it is early, and Biden will not be inaugurated for another 2.5 months.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has been declared the winner of the bitterly divisive U.S. election, denying President Donald Trump a second term in the White House. Several U.S. news networks, including the Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, made the call after Biden increased his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, with vote counting still ongoing in several states. His win in Pennsylvania gave him enough electoral votes needed to enter the White House. His supporters poured into the streets in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., and several other cities across the country to celebrate the victory. However, the election results represent a widening rift in the American society. Even though Joe Biden received over 75 million votes, breaking the record for more popular votes than any other president in U.S. history, President Donald Trump managed to garner more than 70 million votes.
There's growing political division in the United States to a level that hasn't been seen in a really long time. You have crumbling infrastructure across the country. You have rising unemployment. They're talking about a second and third lockdown in the United States. The economic situation is really dire. And so two wings of the ruling parties in the United States are fighting against each other.
Many observers had anticipated that the outcome of the election would be disappointing for either side if the other secured victory. But the tight race between the two candidates shows how polarized the American public has become. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the results in court.
And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on. And this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election.
He has challenged the results in several states, including Arizona, where the president's campaign filed a lawsuit alleging that Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by in-person voters on Election Day. In a statement, Trump said Biden is rushing falsely to pose as the winner and the election is far from over. This is despite that a stream of heads of state have already congratulated Biden on his election victory. Trump's unsubstantiated claims about the election results and the possibility of fraud are adding fuel to the already smoldering fire burning in the U.S. society. Trump supporters, some carrying weapons, have rallied in several U.S. cities protesting the results and echoing the president's allegations of fraud, saying the election was stolen.
I think what this election has shown above all else is that the U.S. claim of being legitimate and democratic and having free, fair, and quick elections is collapsing. Nobody believes that myth anymore. And the fact that a country like Bolivia, for example, had faster, more efficient elections even after a coup than the United States just goes to show that.
President-elect Joe Biden seems to have recognized the threat. In his victory speech, he pledged to heal what he called a divided America.
For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now let's give each other a chance.
But how long will it take until he manages to fulfill his promise, if at all?
I first participated in the Interfaith Symposium in its inaugural year in 2015, and this is my third time visiting with you. I'm grateful to the convener of the Interfaith Symposium, Karen Danielson, for her long-standing friendship, and over the last 4 years, I have participated in events across Chicago at the Mosque Foundation and at the Universal High School. She and her colleagues have visited my synagogue. Some of these interfaith events we shared with other speakers today. So I'm happy to be with all of you today. So my comments today are in two parts. First, I talk about my relationship as a rabbi and a Jew to Muslims and Palestinians. Second, I point to a pressing concern I have about Jewish-Christian interfaith. Now, there are rabbis whose job it is to do interfaith. They have advanced degrees in the subject. Interfaith is in their job description. It's on their business cards. I am not one of them. The reason why I am here and not them is because of the positions I have taken on Palestine in distinction to theirs. In particular, unlike some of my colleagues, I would never demand that Muslims refrain from speaking their minds and their hearts on Israel-Palestine as a prerequisite for interfaith dialogue with me. I am a rabbi, and I wholeheartedly endorse BDS, the three-part Palestinian call for justice and equality. I say yes to BDS, in the first place because it is what the Palestinians have asked of us. I say yes to BDS because until Palestinians are free, neither will the Jews be free. And I'm here to tell you that along with Jewish Voice for Peace, not all Jews support the State of Israel's persecution of Palestinians, and the views I hold are held by hundreds of thousands of other Jews. Now, when you turn outward, away from your religious group, you inevitably turn your back on some of your own, or so some people will feel. And these people may act on their feelings. And as my esteemed interfaith colleagues in the earlier session know, building bridges to other faiths and ethnic or racial groups can mean burning bridges within the faith, losing friends, and even straining family relations. I know. I have experienced all of that. The walls around each of our religions are designed in part to keep them out and us in. And discovering that the best of Jewish values are also Christian and Muslim can be threatening to some people's identity. But my experience teaches me that the rewards of reaching out surpass the risk and the cost. First and foremost, there is the joy and freedom of speaking one's hopes and aspirations honestly and living in alignment with the call for justice. Secondly, for every friend I have lost in the Jewish community, I have made wonderful new friends in other communities such as here, and indeed new friends in the Jewish community. Let me tell you a little bit about my family history as it informs my interfaith work. Over a century ago, my paternal grandfather was orphaned in a white supremacist massacre against Jews in his native Ukraine. 80 years ago, my mother lost her parents when the Nazi state murdered them and 6 million other people for the crime of being born Jews. And in both cases, non-Jews were instrumental in saving their lives. My mother's life was saved through a remarkable operation, a collaboration between Jews and Quakers in my native England. And now while I carry my grandfather and mother's experience with me, I am blessed that my own political reality is so different to what they experienced as children. After all, I am a white middle-class Jew in America. And so in previous years, I attended Mass Ikna to stand in solidarity with the religious community whose political reality is closer to that of my grandparents than my own. A community with many first-generation immigrants who are targeted by the government and others on account of their skin color, race, or religion. This year, however, is different. Yes, I am here in solidarity, but this year, I have skin in the game too, Jewish skin. You see, in the past year of 2019, something fundamental changed for me. Interfaith has become both more complicated and at the same time more urgent. Interfaith is such a compelling idea in no small part because of the perception in society that religion is divisive. In response, interfaith makes the bold claim that our particular religious traditions need not drive us apart, but actually draw us closer to each other. We must scale the walls around our own religions to build bridges with others. And when we cross those bridges, we need to have honest conversation and ask open-ended questions with an open heart and truly address our concerns to bring ourselves to the conversation. Pittsburgh, Poway, Jersey City, friends, 2019 brought the unwelcome, unprecedented phenomenon of the periodic murder of Jews in America every few months. It exposed the ugly undercurrent of anti-Semitism, not just in areas where hatred of minorities is perhaps commonplace, but also in genteel suburbia and the big cities. And as we come to the end of 2019, the good intentions and positivity of past interfaith gatherings will no longer suffice. After years of building goodwill and collaborating in so many beautiful ways, the time has come in this relationship to risk some honesty. And this is my honest talk. The conversations at Jewish Hanukkah celebrations this year turned to how safe it is to publicly identify as a Jew. A few years ago, such fears would have been deemed irrational. Not anymore. And as a Jew, I am afraid. And as a Jew, I know what it is to be in the religious majority. I have had that experience. I was an Israeli Jew for 20 years. I grew up in a country where Jewish concerns were self-evident and those of others were not well represented. I grew up in a country where the evidence of the Nakba was all around me, but there was no narrative, no awareness for the majority Jews to make moral or emotional sense of it. And so, the Palestinian past was a ghost, and the Palestinian present was irrelevant or a threat. It was only when I came here and joined the American Jewish community that I saw the fundamental injustice of the Israeli system with regard to the Palestinians. Only when I became a religious minority in a Christian majority country was I able to see Israel in perspective. Some of you who came from Muslim majority countries and are now a religious minority as American Muslims may have had a similar reassessment of how you see your home countries. So where does the interfaith community go from here? The bottom line is that even as interfaith relations are so important, I can no longer engage in them with blind trust in the goodwill of my counterparts. Back in April 2019, a religious man prayed hateful words on Good Friday. A week later, he took the life of a Jew in synagogue on a holy day as she prayed to God. The murderer said, "I learned that it was right to kill Jews in church." Not that his church or any church preached violence against Jews, far from it. But words do matter. What we say in our houses of worship at elevated moments of emotion, on sacred days and in deep moments of prayer, truly matter. Words are the stuff of religion, holy writ, scripture, liturgy, prayer, sermon, and we need to get it right. So, henceforth, I will ask my interfaith partners, when you pray, how do you speak of the Jews? And perhaps I have now come to the same place as the organizers of this wonderful interfaith symposium. Namely, not all interfaith partners are equally welcome. There have to be some basic standards for engagement. So going forward, I will ask direct questions and listen carefully to the answers. Perhaps that is what it means to be Jewish. Perhaps that is what it means to be a religious minority. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio.